Wow, this is the second time I've been here, so I'm really grateful to be here. I came last year. I didn't do a Wednesday talk, but so some of you may not have ever seen me before, don't know anything about me. And I just know at Seattle Insight, which is like our sister Sangha, Narayan, I spent many years going on retreat with Rodney Smith, which was our guiding teacher, and Narayan. And then I hear that Rodney would come up here. So it's sort of like we are sister sanghas, because Narayan and Rodney were like sisters and brothers. So I don't know if you guys ever saw them together, but oh my God, they're so funny. They're so different. It's so funny. So I feel a kindred spirit with you. So I thought coming here, you know, a lot of teachers come to Seattle Insight and they give Dhamma talks. If those teachers are famous teachers, like if Philip Moffat comes or Joseph Goldstein comes, you know, they just give a Dhamma talk. But if someone new comes, there's kind of a, who is that person? I mean, a Dhamma talk is good, but who is that person giving that Dhamma talk? I don't even know if I should listen to that Dhamma. It may not be my Dhamma. So I thought the best talk I could give is how it is that I came into the Dhamma and why I take refuge in it. So why would I be sitting here giving a Dhamma talk to people to encourage and inspire you to stay in your practice? How is it that I came into this place here? So then the next time you see me and I'm giving some Dhamma talk on, you know, one of the lists, you might listen a little bit closer because you're like, oh, I know her. I can listen to that. So I thought I would use the refuges, especially taking refuge in the Dhamma, to kind of introduce myself to you so you know who I am, where I come from, and sort of create a relationship with us, because the Dhamma is relational, and a lot of our inspiration comes from the relationship that happens. So I thought I would start with this idea of refuge, because that is not a word that I ever used in my life before I became a Buddhist. I didn't use this word refuge. And I just think some words are, I always tell Sims that there are words that are, you know, not black words. And refuge would not be a black word. So I never had this understanding of refuge. But when I came into the Dhamma, I can say that I took refuge in a lot of things before I became a practitioner. So just to give you a few so you kind of know the world I came from. I came from a lot of violence. So I took refuge in anger and intimidation. I could get my way if I got loud enough and big enough, I could get whatever I wanted. And I didn't necessarily get loud and big to be mean. I got loud and big to get my way. And then everybody's happy. And so I took refuge in a lot of anger and a lot of intimidation. I mean, I was a prosecutor, so prosecutors have a way of being intimidating. Whether we want to be intimidating or not, we are. And so this capacity to intimidate and get what I want, I learned that at home, and I used that for many, 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 many years. I took refuge in education, went all the way through law school, and I was very cocky, smart, very smart, top of the class. I graduated summa cum, so I was very cocky. Not very many people were as smart as me. And even if people thought they were as smart as me, I didn't think they were smart as me. So, you know, I was like really above the top. And I lived in education because it was safe. I was at the top, and I could command and do whatever I wanted to do. So I took refuge in education for a long, 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 long time. And I was raised a Black Baptist, and I could sing really, really well. And so I would get in a choir, and the church was a big deal for me. And so I took a lot of refuge in my spiritual practice, in church, going to church, taking leadership roles. There was something about me in a leadership role. I took refuge in all of that. So basically, my childhood, which was quite, it was quite abusive, set me on this path where my religion was gonna pretty much save me. My anger was definitely gonna save me because I was tall and not very many people are gonna come up, you know, bump up against an angry Black woman. So I could always step in that. And smart and educated person. So I had this sense when I left out of high school that basically I could command my life and do whatever I wanted to do and it would be fine. That even though I came from mess, I could turn the corner and I could go off and I could be whoever I wanted to be and do whatever I wanted to do and nothing was gonna get in my way, nothing was even gonna stop that. No, what? I was perfect. And then of course, I was a Virgo, so we're always right. In case the rest of you guys didn't know. And then I failed the bar the second time. And the world, this refuge that I had taken, just flat dropped out. The first time I failed, I told people on Saturday, when I failed the bar the first time, I thought there was something wrong with the bar. So I just took it the second time thinking they just probably wanted more money, it's stupid questions. And I took it the second time and failed it the second time. And this thing hit me that there was something wrong with me. What I thought was that somehow my cockiness, my fake, the thing that I didn't want anyone to know about me, the stuff that I had hidden, I thought I had ran it out. And basically, the world was coming to an end. And I had two boys, and I was a single parent, and I thought I had used up all my good favors. So I was gonna step into this world of misery. And what I couldn't do was accept that I would be in that world unhappy. So one other refuge that I took from my childhood, my father was very volatile and angry, and my mother was very optimistic. She was so optimistic that she didn't see any of the trouble that was going on, but she was so happy all the time, and everybody else had to be happy around her. So I took refuge in playing, and I used to play with my kids all the time, and we had so much fun, so there was all this playing, joy, happiness, and as long as I was in the playing, joy, happiness, everything's good. So here I am face to face with this uncomfortable decision, this kind of recognition that I'm going to live in misery for the rest of my life. This is what I was thinking, suffering, sorrow. I had been conned, basically. Everyone told me, get a good education, be smart, work hard. It's all going to be okay. And it was not okay. So I went to Barnes & Noble. That's my library. And I looked for a book. I remembered when I was an undergrad studying Buddhism, and I remembered that the Buddha said he came to teach on suffering. I didn't remember the other half, the end of suffering, but I could remember that he came to teach about suffering, and I figured he was a pro at suffering, and so I would go and study up what he said, thinking that I would be able to be in this miserable life I was going to have, no law, just going to get some stupid job. That was all it was going to be. And I was going to do that, and I'd be okay. So I found this book by Trungpa Rinpoche called Training the Mind, Cultivating Loving Kindness. I didn't know anything about Trungpa Rinpoche's past, but I learned later. It's like, oh, Lord. I don't know if I would have necessarily read his book. It's a good thing I didn't know about him. But it's about it's a Tibetan practice on the 59 slogans. And some of the slogans would say things like, abandon all hope. There's a slogan that says, drive all blames into one. Exchange your happiness for another. I mean, there were all these slogans that were about, give it up, it's all over. Take your medicine and keep on moving. So I thought, this is what I need to learn. And so I started practice. And I thought that the 45 minute sit is what you're supposed to do. 45 minutes. So every day for 10 years, I would sit for 45 minutes in silence. And I would read one slogan a day, get to the end of the book, go back, start all over again. 10 years. Read a slogan, get to the end of the book, go back, start all over again. I got to kind of qualify a couple of things. Because I practiced in a closet. I didn't know what it is I was doing, so I was afraid of it. But if one of the boys opened the closet door, one of my sons kind of opened the closet door, I would be all serious, very quiet, and they would close the door, and then I would relax, sitting there. There was a time my mother would come and visit, and she would come and open the door, and I'd be serious, sitting there, and then she would close the door, and I would relax. I didn't quite know exactly what I was doing, but something about this was calling me, and I was stuck with it. Like, I didn't really understand any of it, but I was called to it. There's a calling. You may not know that there's a calling that happens in this room, but there's a calling that brings us in the room. And in some respects, if we share what we've gone through over the course of our practice, people would look at us and say, and you still practice? Something brings us in the room that's different. And I think that bringing in the room, that calling that comes to us, has a lot to do with how Buddha stepped on the path. I mean, when he stepped on the path, he stepped on this path by going against everything in his culture he should have done. He left his wife and kid. I mean, just left them in the dead of night, no doubt. This is the way the story goes. He just, like, packed his stuff up and hit the road. But he's a Buddha. And he left his wife and kids. So he left them. He left his family and money and went on a religious journey that took him deeper and deeper and deeper into poverty. So anyone in this room that has kids, the last thing you want them to do is to go deeper and deeper and deeper into poverty. You want them to go deeper and deeper and deeper into money so they're self-sufficient and they won't be knocking on your door. But he didn't. He goes deeper and deeper and deeper into poverty. So to put some reality into this, when you see these people lying around on the streets with nothing, barely able to keep themselves together, that is the Buddha that we look at. He was not clean. He had to be dirty. He was sleeping on the ground all the time. There's a bit of maybe sparkliness to him, but he had to leave everything he knew to be true and turn this corner towards the Dhamma. That has to be a calling. It has to be something other than you that pulls you into it. So he gets pulled in. And I can remember when I very first started practicing that image of the Buddha going off into this new world is what really kept me thinking, this is something I should do. Because when I entered the Dhamma, it was like in the mid-80s or around the, I got out of law school in about 86, 87, so it was sort of around in there. And I didn't know anything. I don't even think there was a Cambridge. There's no Cambridge Insight. So there's no place to come and sit with people like you. It was just me being pulled by something that I didn't even understand. I didn't have a Sangha. I didn't have a teacher. There's no dharmaseed.org where you can just listen to the little Dhamma talks. There was just nothing. Just me and my book. And I would read it and read it and read it. And something began to happen to me. I begin to notice how my behavior was affecting other people around me. I begin to notice, it's like a thawing. And maybe that some of you know what I'm talking about, but there's like a thawing, a kind of a way that you look in the mirror and say, my God, you're so harsh. And there's like a thawing. So this is an example of the thawing that began to occur. My sons and I were watching TV one time, and this commercial came on. It was these two weeds. One was a tall, thin weed, like a laurel and hardy, and one was a short, fat weed. And they had suitcases, and they were scurrying, trying to get out of town. And the one weed said, do you think we're going to get out? Do you think we can make it? And the other weed's like, I don't know. Let's just keep going. Just keep going. And then this giant boot came, and this Roundup squished, and they died. I lost it. I lost it. I was so upset. And all I kept saying was, they were just trying to get out of town. And my sons were just sort of looking at me like, what has happened to our mother? But there was this thawing around kindness that I can't even explain, and all I was doing was halfway sitting quietly and reading this book, trying to put these slogan ideas into practice. And it was all with the intention to get away, to learn how to be with suffering and not be sad. So fast forward, I moved to Seattle, and I had a friend that wanted to go to Seattle Insight. By then, I had passed the bar. I was practicing as a prosecutor, and by the time I moved to Seattle, I had to take the bar again. During all that time, I met this friend. It was right around 9/11. this friend said, there's this teacher named Rodney, and he's giving a beginning class. I want to go. I'm not a beginner. I've been practicing for 10 years. I'm a Buddha almost. What are you talking about? I didn't even want to go. And she just kept insisting that I go with her. Please, please, would I go with her? Please, please. She was white. I said, okay, I'll go. Just to help you get into this whole Dhamma Buddha thing, but I don't need any beginning instructions. And so I went that evening, and first, so my whole spiritual world was following someone of color, because Buddha was of color, my church was of color. I walked into this room with all these white people, and the teacher was white. And I thought, no, I can't do this. I can't do that. I can't do this. She's like, please, please, stay, stay. I'm thinking, I'm only doing this for you. Kindness. That's what I'm trying to work on, my friendlier side. So I stayed, and something about the way Rodney talked about the Dhamma, it was so direct and so clear and so spot on that I thought he knew something and I wanted to know what it was. That I had somehow or another found something. It wasn't a guess. It was like he knew and I wanted to find out. And so my early years into Sims was really like just listening to Rodney. That's it. Rodney, Rodney, Rodney. Rodney, Rodney, Rodney. That's all it was. Whatever Rodney said, that's the Dhamma. And some of you kind of know what I'm talking about because you get so caught up in the teacher, what the teacher says about the Dhamma, that that's all you really know is how to quote what the teacher says about the Dhamma. And I went on a retreat. This retreat was in 2006, and it changed my whole life. It was extremely difficult retreat, extremely uncomfortable. I had gotten myself stuck in an unbelievable layer of anxiety, and nothing Rodney said was making it go away. I kept doing what he said, and it wasn't going away. It wasn't going away. It wasn't going away. And I got to this retreat, and somehow I applied the Dhamma. I don't know how I did it. I think it comes from listening, 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 going, 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 doing, doing, doing. And then something happens. The dots get put together. The mind understands something. And on this retreat, it put everything I knew into order. And I felt that anxiety, not as something I needed to get rid of, but just something. I mean, we've all been sitting here, so everybody's been feeling the sensation of a chair or a cushion, but how often do we pay attention to that? It's just a sensation. I begin to understand this understanding that all of these sensations rise and pass away. I begin to understand impermanence, and I begin to understand it wasn't about me in that moment. Something else was going on. So when I came home, I changed the way I looked at the Dhamma. I started looking for how I could find the Dhamma in any situation. So if I watch TV, and I loved Law and Order, I wish it was like that in real life, but I loved it. And I would look for the Dhamma in Law and Order. I'm not advocating that you do that, because it's going to affect your TV looking at. You can't just drift away anymore. But if I saw a movie, I would look for the Dhamma in it. And there's some things I begin to learn that I want to share about taking refuge in the Dhamma. There is a reason why the Buddha came to talk about suffering and the cessation of suffering. You won't know it if you keep dodging the bullet on suffering. You won't know this. You dodge the bullet and the suffering goes away. Sort of like when we first start practicing and we find out if I look at the itch, it will go away. So I keep looking at these sensations, trying to get them to go away. And you might dodge the bullet and the suffering goes away. But you will not see what the Dhamma can do for you, what it does for the mind. You will not see that bright, luminous liberation that comes if you actually stop running from suffering. That the fact that what I think the Buddha, all by himself, when he sat under the tree, he was alone. I mean, really alone. Because all of the friends that he was practicing with pretty much thought he had punked out because he took some food. And when he took that food, they thought had just blew it. And so they kind of wrote him off. So his family's written him off, and his community's written him off, and now his only five little practitioners together in a little group, they've written him off. So he's sitting there all by himself. And I think this is significant when you think about the application of the Dhamma. He's sitting there all by himself with all the regret, the same anger, the same irritation, the same desire for the bell to ring, all of that. He's sitting there by himself with it. So what do you think he had? What do you think that he had that when we're sitting in Dhamma, or when I was sitting in Dhamma, what's the difference? And I think it came from that retreat. Because the famous little quote that you don't look at the finger pointing at the moon, you look at the moon. You guys heard that? So think of it like this. If you want to see the moon, you have got to let go of the finger. You're not seeing the moon if you're holding the finger, if you're looking at the finger. But when I was listening to the instructions of Rodney's, every word, writing it down, trying to remember it, I was looking at the finger the whole time. Because he's giving me the instruction to turn and look at the moon. And the only way you're ever going to see the moon is you have to let go of the teacher. You have to let go of looking at the teacher and turn towards your own situation right there. And it has to be in suffering. It has to be in suffering because suffering is the only thing that will draw our attention to an urgency right now. I need to do something about this. So I kept trying to take what Rodney taught, somehow remember Rodney, call on him, beg him to come into my sit and help me with this anxiety. That's what the whole point was. What did Rodney say about anxiety? I should try that. And I would try it. It's like, it's not working. Because think about it, Rodney was in the back of my head the whole time, trying to tell me how to get rid of anxiety. And I know if Rodney could help me get rid of anxiety, he would have done it. He would have came into my sit and said, get out of here, if he could. But he couldn't. And at that retreat, I let go of Rodney and looked at the anxiety. Like, what are you? What is this panic that's always showing up? Why do you show up? Why are you there? And when I started looking at the anxiety itself, looking at the suffering itself, it became very clear what it was, why it was there, what was going on. It was not my mother, nor was it my father. It was not about anything that I had gone through in all my childhood. It's just the nature of this human body to be excessive with energy. It's a hindrance. It is there. It is part of the sloth and torpor, the aversion, the desire, the doubt, all of it shows up in practice. And I kept thinking it was some big thing that I had to take on. And instead, I had to just begin to learn how to look at it. So in the Dhamma, there are so many ways to look at suffering. We spent the weekend talking about the three characteristics. You can look at it from that door. You could look at it from the Four Noble Truths. You could look at it from like the five faculties or all these wonderful, the paramis. There's so many doors to look at suffering, to get us to stay with it. The Brahmaviharas, stay right there. You don't need anything but that edge to push up against. And I saw its liberation. I saw it leave. And when I got back home, I was full of this desire and, you know, a little bit of selfing ego because I had diminished all of it. Felt like I was a Buddha. But it came back. Took 3 years of looking at this anxiety for me to understand it fully. The Dhamma is a weird application because we need to listen to a teacher to inspire us, to encourage us, to tell us what those instructions are. But every time you sit down and you close your eyes and you sit in that meditation process, you are applying the Dhamma. That's what you're doing. When you're at work and you are irritated, that is where you gotta find the Dhamma there. That's the moon right there. I used to pat myself on the back every time I got mad, every time I got irritated, every time something would go wrong. I'd be like, okay, here, all right, this is an opportunity to practice. And all my friends, even people now, get sick of me because they'll come and say, oh my God, I lost my job. I'm so worried. I'm like, oh my God, that's good. Let's practice with that. I can't help it because I know that there's a reason why Buddha would say suffering and the end of suffering. You will not see the end of suffering unless you're willing to see into the nature of suffering. So every opportunity that comes your way, every difficulty that comes your way, you may not think of it this way, but that is your moment of liberation. If someone had told me that when I went on that retreat, I would see the end of anxiety as it's right there with me, I would have not believed them. But then that was it. That's all it took. So then there's like one third part of this whole process of taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dhamma is the Sangha part. And I am certain if it hadn't have been for me to go and see, go into Sims with my friend at that beginning class, I would have never seen this. I would have never seen that degree of liberation, because when I was sitting in the closet, I only saw what I was willing to tolerate. I could be, as long as I was calm and everything was good, I could tolerate it. But I couldn't tolerate great difficulty. If every single one of us in this room were in an isolated space trying to look at great difficulty, you could see it as far as you could see it. But at some point, you're just going to kind of give up. But if you knew that I was also looking at great difficulty, and she's looking at great difficulty, and he's looking at great difficulty, we're all looking at great difficulty, we're all looking at suffering, we're all bumping up against each other, feeling into the suffering, not begrudging it, but actually appreciating the gift it is when it shows up, then the thing that calls us into this room, the thing that swirls around in the room, then it begins to make sense why you need a sangha. You need that sangha to know you're not crazy. There's nothing wrong with wanting to understand the nature of suffering. There's nothing wrong with wanting to look at your aversion, look at your anger, and not just push up against it and get your way. There's nothing wrong with wanting to live your life out of a sense of no harm. Those vows that we kind of all take, this vow of non-harming or causing the least amount of harm, this vow of goodwill and kindness towards everyone, all living sentient beings, this vow of restraint, just wanting to practice and see into the nature of restraint, not talking, you know, changing the way that we relate to pleasure all the time. Those kinds of things in this room make sense. But outside there, it doesn't always make sense. So here in this Sangha, we have to encourage each other to stay with this idea of suffering as a means, as a gateway, as a door for me to liberate the mind. It's my moon that I'm looking at. So I've been with Sims for 15, almost, I guess, 16, so many years. It was 2001, in that September that we started that beginning class. And we go through ups and downs, as all sanghas do, in and out. But there is a gratitude that Sims is there for most all of us that practice there. I mean, I went from being a regular beginning class yogi volunteer into being their guiding teacher in a very, very difficult time when I was asked to be the guiding teacher. So there's kind of like a kindred spirit there. And I want to leave you with a story, and we'll take some questions and hear some comments about how you are with this idea of refuge and how you take refuge, I mean, in the practice here. But I want to leave you with this story that this woman in this beginning class several years ago shared with us. And I just think it's what refuge is. So, she was in this beginning class, and at the end of the beginning class, we have like a post-beginning class that talks more about the Buddhist Dhamma list, Four Noble Truths, Three Characteristics, things like that. Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And so she had ended the beginning class, and there's like a two-week break, and then the post-beginning class starts. So this was one of the nights on the post-beginning class, in the beginning of it. And she comes in and she says she wants to share this story, but she doesn't think anyone's going to understand. But she just needs to say it out loud because something remarkable happened. She said that her and her husband and son went on a vacation after the beginning class. And somehow somebody left something out. And when they got back, there were all these flies all over the house. And the son and husband were on a mission to get rid of these flies. And they were smacking and killing and getting rid of the flies. There was a whole bunch of them, I guess, that was in the house. And she said she kept having this tension about this. Like, and she says in passing, do you think there's another way we could get the flies out without killing them? And her son, her husband kind of looked at her like, are you crazy? I was like, that is the stupidest thing I ever heard. And it was all this kerfuffle about getting the flies. It took them, she said, most of the day going through the house looking for these flies, killing, killing, killing. And she didn't even understand why she had such a visceral in the body feeling about these flies. She didn't like flies either. She said, then she goes in the room after it seems like the flies are all gone. And she's laying on the bed, and it's her dog on the bed and her on the bed, and then she hears this fly. And her whole body begins to get in a tizzy, restless, big deal. And she said something shifted, and she said, oh, I'm in here by myself. It's just me, the dog, and the fly. And she just laid there on the bed, listening to the fly buzzing about, listening to the dog breathing, feeling the bed, feeling quite content. She shares that story with us. Afterward, she said that she went out and told their husband and son about this glorious moment she had in the bed, lying there with the dog and the fly. They were like, fly? Fly? Where's the fly? She's like, it's gone. I let it out. She told this story to us, and she goes, I know you guys don't understand what I'm saying. And I asked everyone in the room to raise their hand who understands. So I'm asking you, who understands what she's talking about in that story? Raise your hand. That is taking refuge. It is this understanding that we have about the Dhamma, about suffering, about difficulty, about stress, about life, about death, about coming and going and being together in community and connected or not connected, all that stuff that goes on. There is something about beginning to understand in like-minded circles what it feels like to just be okay with whatever's going on as it's going on, to be okay with looking at suffering, to be okay with just the practice is enough. So that's my offering, my reflections. Thank you very much.